And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, this is October 27th. 300th day of the year. In leap years, 301st day. 365 days remain to the end of the year. And this has been quite a momentous date in history. In the year 312 AD, Constantine, the Emperor of Rome, is said to have had his vision. Now, this was before the Battle of Melvin Bridge. Between the Roman Emperors Constantine I and Maxentius. And the battle took place October 28th. Gets its name from the Milvian Bridge, an important route over the Tiber. Constantine won the battle and began the path that led him to the end of the triumvirate that ruled Rome, became the sole ruler of the Roman Empire. During the battle, Maxentius drowned in the Tiber. And they took his body out of the river and cut his head off and paraded it through the streets of Rome. Now, according to chroniclers such as Eusebius of Caesarea and Lactantius, the battle marked the beginning of Constantine's conversion to Christianity. Till that point in time, Christianity had been a cult. Paganism was the primary religion. But Eusebius writes about Constantine and his soldiers having a vision that was sent by Christ. And this was interpreted as a promise of victory if the sign of the Chiro, the first two letters of Christ's name in Greek, was painted on the soldiers' shields. And the Ark of Constantine, erected in celebration of the victory, attributes his success to divine intervention. But the monument really doesn't display any overt Christian symbolism. Now, it's commonly understood, on the evening of October 27th, with the armies preparing for battle, and Constantine was not a sure winner, he had a vision that led him to fight under the protection of the Christian God. Now, depending on who tells the story, some of the details do differ. Lactantius states on the night before the battle, Constantine was commanded in a dream to delineate the heavenly sign on the shields of his soldiers. And he followed the commands he got in the dream and marked the shields with a sign denoting Christ. Lactantius describes the sign as a storogram or a Latin cross with its upper end rounded in a P-like fashion. Now, there's no real evidence Constantine ever used that sign, opposed to the better-known Chiro sign described by Eusebius. But whatever may have been the reason for it, he did have that sign on the shields of his soldiers, and he did win the battle. In 939, Æthelstan, the first king of all England, dies and is succeeded by his half-brother, Edmund I. One thing about English royalty, they did like their women. 1275, traditional founding of the city of Amsterdam. 1524, French troops lay siege to Pavia. 1553, condemned as a heretic, Michael Servetius is burned at the stake just outside Geneva. "You don't believe the way I believe, you're gonna die," seemed to be the philosophy of the ancient world. Now, none of the beliefs had court evidence that would stand up in court, but whoever had the most believers won. '44, English Civil War, Second Battle of Newbury. 1682, Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, Philadelphia is founded. 1775, King George III expands on his proclamation of rebellion in the 13 colonies in his speech from the throne at the opening of Parliament. 1795, U.S. and Spain sign the Treaty of Madrid, which establishes the boundaries between Spanish colonies and the U.S., and then after that everybody proceeded to ignore them. 1806, French army enters Berlin following the Battle of Auerstedt. 1810, the U.S. annexes the former Spanish colony of West Florida. My ancestors was living in an area in Florida and got a Spanish land grant. And my family has a tradition, the oldest son will fight with his father and leave. And when the oldest son came back, he found his little town had grown up over onto the family land. And they wouldn't leave. Well, that little town became Jacksonville, Florida. 1838, Missouri Governor Lilburn Boggs issues the extermination order that orders all Mormons to leave the state or be killed. Remember, believe as I believe or die. 1870, Franco-Prussian War. Marshal Bazaine surrenders to Prussian forces at the conclusion of the siege of Metz, along with 440,000 French soldiers. 1904, first underground New York City subway line opens, later designated as the IRT Broadway 7th Avenue line. Been on that. Interesting subway. 1907, 15 people were killed in Hungary when a gunman opens fire on a crowd gathered at a church consecration. 1914, World War I, the new British battleship HMS Audacious, sunk by a minefield laid by armed German merchant cruiser Berlin. 1916, Negus Michael, marching on the Ethiopian capital in support of his son, Emperor Eusu V, is defeated by Fitolari Apt Georgis, securing the throne for Empress Zuditu I. There was an emperor in Ethiopia until the Italians conquered the country. 1922, a referendum in Rhodesia rejects the country's annexation to the South African Union. Cecil Rhodes actually founded that country. 1924, the Uzbek SSR is founded in the Soviet Union. 1930, ratifications exchanged in London for the first London Naval Treaty go into effect immediately, further limiting the expansive naval arms race among its five signatories. 1936, Ms. Wallace Simpson obtains her divorce that would eventually allow her to marry King Edward VIII of the UK, forcing his abdication from the throne. Now, he could actually have stayed on the throne, but politically, his senior advisors basically cut his throat. 1944, German forces capture Banská Bystrica during Slovak national uprising, bringing it to an end. 1954, Benjamin Davis Jr. becomes the first African-American general. Excuse me, in the U.S. Air Force. Being out in the snow this morning was not a good move. 1958, Iskander Mirza, first president of Pakistan, is deposed by General Ayub Khan, but appointed 20 days earlier by the president to enforce martial law. 1961.
Motion detected at the front door.
NASA tests the first Saturn I rocket in mission Saturn Apollo 1. 1962. Major Rudolph Anderson of the United States Air Force becomes the only human casualty of the Cuban Missile Crisis. His U-2 reconnaissance airplane is shot down over Cuba by a Soviet-supplied surface-to-air missile. I don't know why I'm sneezing so much. In 1962, by refusing to agree to the firing of a nuclear torpedo to U.S. warship, Vasily Arkhipov averts nuclear war. He had been given the order to sink one of the American ships blockading Cuba, and he refused. 1962, an aircraft carrying Enrico Mattei, post-war Italian administrator, crashes in very mysterious circumstances. May well have been sabotage. 1964, Ronald Reagan delivers a speech on behalf of Republican candidate for President Barry Goldwater. The speech launches his political career and comes to be known as a time for choosing. 1967, Catholic priest Philip Berrigan and others at the Baltimore Four protest the Vietnam War by pouring blood on Selective Service records. Everybody wanted to be an activist. Nobody wanted to do their job. 1971, Democratic Republic of Congo is renamed Zaire. 1979, St. Vincent and the Grenadines gains its independence from the United Kingdom. 1981, Soviet submarine S-363 runs aground on the east coast of Sweden. 1996, the British government suddenly deregulates financial markets, leading to a total restructuring of the way in which they operate in the country. That's an event that's now been referred to as the Big Bang. 1988, Ronald Reagan suspends construction of a new U.S. embassy in Moscow due to Soviet listening devices they were finding embedded in the building structure. 1991, Turkmenistan achieves independence from the Soviet Union. 1992, United States Navy radio man Aaron Schindler Jr. is murdered by shipmate Terry Helvey for being gay, precipitating debate about gays in the military that resulted in the United States policy, Don't Ask, Don't Tell. 1994, Gliese 229b is the first substellar mass object to be unquestionably identified. 1995, former Prime Minister of Italy, Bettino Craxi, is convicted in absentia of corruption. 1997, the 1997 Asian financial crisis causes a crash in the Dow Jones Industrial Average. 1999, gunmen opened fire in the Armenian parliament, killed the prime minister and seven others. In 2004, the Boston Red Sox defeat the St. Louis Cardinals to win their first World Series in 86 years. 2014, Britain withdraws from Afghanistan at the end of Operation Herrick after 12 years, 4 months, and 7 days supporting the United States. 2017, Catalonia declares independence from Spain. 2018, a gunman opens fires on a Pittsburgh synagogue, kills 11, injures 6, including 4 police officers. 2019, Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant founder and leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, kills himself and 3 children by detonating a suicide vest during the U.S. military Berisha raid in northwestern Syria. I guess it falls under the heading, they can dish it out, but can they take it? A lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Holidays, Christian feast day, Aban, Abraham the Poor, Frumentius in the Roman Catholic Church, Gaudiosus of Naples, Caleb of Aksum, Nemantius in Damas, Aran of Iona, Cernovo Tragedy Day in Slovakia, Flag Day in Greece, Independence Day in St. Vincent and the Grenadines, Navy Day in the United States. The official date's actually October 13th. This is the unofficial original date. And World Day of Audiovisual Heritage. Now, what that means, anybody's guess. Let's see what else we got on this date in history. All right. In 625, Honorius I begins his reign as Catholic Pope. And in 710, the Saracens invade Sardinia. In 1507, Portuguese Admiral Alfonso de Albuquerque captures the Persian fortress of Hormuz on Hormuz Island. In 1644, in the Second Battle of Newbury, King Charles I beats the parliamentary armies. Eventually, they wind up winning and cutting his head off. In 1651, English troops occupy Limerick, Ireland. And in 1688, King James II dismisses Premier Robert Spencer. 1702, British troops plunder St. Augustine, Florida. 1775 on this date. The U.S. Navy forms as a Continental Navy. 1795, Pinckney's Treaty, the Treaty of San Lorenzo, signed by Spain and the U.S., establishes the southern border of the U.S., and gives us the right to navigate the Mississippi River. 1867, Giuseppe Garibaldi marches on Rome for the second time. He unified Italy. 1871, Boss Tweed, the Democratic leader of the Tammany Hall organization in New York City, is arrested after the New York Times exposes his corruption. At one point in time, the New York Times was a real journalistic paper, instead of being an organ of the Democratic Party. 1907, the first trial of the so-called Uhlenberg Affair, which had rocked the highest circles of Germany, comes to an end. 1913, President Wilson swears the U.S. will never attack another country. 1919, the Axeman of New Orleans claims his last victim, at least the last known victim. All right, we've covered our history. We were talking about the Skull and Bones and the fact that they have affected, members of that organization have affected a lot of events at the highest levels. In fact, it was Prescott Bush and UBC that actually helped fund Adolf Hitler and the Nazi Party. And everybody did everything they could to take the heat off of Prescott Bush. He had friends everywhere. In fact, to show that he wasn't anti-American, he became the chairman of the United Services Organization, or we know it as the USO. And he traveled the country over the next 2 years raising millions for the National War Fund. Put himself on a national stage for the first time and boosted the morale of U.S. troops. Well, the problem is the fact that the organizations he was involved with, the banking organizations, were staunch supporters of Nazi Germany. They helped Thyssen move $3 million in cash into New York. Now, Herskowitz, who wrote Duty on Our Country, which traces the career of Prescott Bush, who became a U.S. senator in 1952 and political confidant of Richard Nixon, he just fawned over the man. He was wonderful. He was this. He was that. Well, according to the Herald Tribune article, appeared in the summer of 1942, suggesting that Prescott Bush had already assumed an anti-Nazi stance with his participation in the USO. I mean, how could anybody question the patriotism of a Wall Street financial heavyweight who takes an active role in supporting U.S. troops? But the Herald Tribune revelation didn't appear in the summer of 42, as Herskowitz said in Duty on Our Country. It appeared on Thursday, July 31st, 1941. The fact that Herskowitz had to know, since he quoted directly from the article itself. In that particular context, it's clear that Bush made his patriotic move into the USO after the appearance of stories connecting him and his bank with a Nazi regime that was so well advanced in its murder of millions of innocent civilians and Allied soldiers. Well, it's clear that it wasn't an obvious altruistic move on the part of Bush to get involved with the USO. Is more like a frantic fence mending, and Herskowitz's lauding story is now clearly a whitewash. Now, Bush and his UBC cronies managed to sweep other dusty smudges under the rug whenever possible. There was an innocuous one-line announcement that appeared in the Financial Times on December 16, 1944, issue of the New York Times. It said the Union Banking Corporation at 39 Broadway in New York has got authority to change its principal place of business to 120 Broadway. That announcement conveniently ignored the fact that UBC had already been taken over by the U.S. federal government under the Trading with the Enemies Act 2 years before. And that the 120 Broadway was actually the address of the office of the alien property custodian. Now, by that time, though, Prescott Bush and his other skull and bone cronies had moved on. As with so many transgressions by Bush and his skull and bones assistants, that was all overlooked. And in fact, they were parading on behalf of victory bonds in their starched shirts and wrapped up in Old Glory, ready to assume the next stage in their shining careers, which in Bush's case included election to the U.S. Senate. Now, this apparent financial political linkage among Skull and Bone members that has alarmed many people over the years. With so much smoke swirling around and about and among both the organization and the U.S. Federal Service, there has to be some fire. Predictably and most disturbingly, the Secret Skull and Bone Society has made its biggest impact on the most influential of all government-administered secret societies, the CIA. Now, I've got a list of, and it's only a partial list, of Bonesmen associated with the intelligence community via the Office of Strategic Services, the OSS, which was the forerunner of the CIA. Hugh Wilson, class of 09. Robert D. French, class of 10. Archibald MacLeish, class of 15. Charles Walker, class of 16. F. Truby Davison, class of 18. Hugh Cunningham, class of 34. Armory Hal Bradford, class of 34. Richard Moore, class of 36. William Bundy, class of 39. McGeorge Bundy, class of 40. Reuben Holden, class of 40. Richard Drain, class of 43. James Buckley, class of 44. George H.W. Bush, class of 48. Sloan Coffin Jr., class of 49. V. Van Dyne, class of 49. William Buckley, class of 50. Dino Pianzio, class of 50. David Boren, class of 63. Now, by definition, Bonesmen are bright, ambitious, and based on their membership in this secret society, eminently qualified to serve in a covert organization like the CIA. And on the surface, this makes a lot of sense. Concerns arise, though, when layers of secrecy concealing many Bonesmen associations and activities are peeled away. And that reveals suggestions of extracurricular clandestine actions and evidence of remarkable coincidences. If you remember the Russell Trust Association, the official corporate name of Skull and Bones, according to records in the state of Connecticut where the organization was registered, Russell Trust Association no longer exists. Now, it does, clearly, since Skull and Bones remains more active and apparently more solvent than ever. The parent organization of Skull and Bones is now known as RTA Incorporated, a name it very quietly and surreptitiously assumed 10:15 a.m., April 14, 1961. Now, that's an interesting date and time because less than 2 hours later, the CIA launched its self-financed and self-directed invasion of Cuba, which led to the disastrous Bay of Pigs debacle. See, a mastermind of this particular disaster was Richard Drain, a Bonesman of the Class of 43. White House liaison was McGeorge Bundy, Skull and Bones Class of 40, working closely with his brother, William P. Bundy, Skull and Bones Class of 39 at the State Department. Together, these three members of Skull and Bones cooked up one of the great financial foreign misadventures in U.S. history and boosted Cuba's prestige in the Third World, highlighted Fidel Castro's claims with U.S. imperialism, and led directly to the Cuban Missile Crisis, which is the closest up to that time the world had ever come to nuclear war. Now, the timing of the change in corporate identity and the Bay of Pigs invasion, you might say, is just coincidence. But with the perspective of history and our knowledge of CIA operations over the years, there clearly is a more practical explanation for this change. While no one's revealed the source of funding that enabled 1,500 Cuban Americans to launch the invasion, suspicion remains that it was U.S. government money via a CIA operations group. But without a defined conduit, however, for the funds, the financial linkage can't be verified. And without an existing Russell Trust Association, any record of a potential involvement of the Skull and Bones parent organization as a covert manager of the funds was erased on the morning of the invasion. There is one fact, though. The individual who handled the paperwork on the name changeover and the incorporation of RTA was Howard Weaver, a Bonesman of the Class of 45 who had conveniently retired from covert work at the CIA less than 2 years before. Now, coincidences grew curiouser and curiouser as time went along. George H.W. Bush, may or may not have been working on behalf of the CIA in the years between 58 and 66, which encompassed the timing of the Bay of Pigs. According to official records, he was only chairman of the board and president of Zapata Offshore Oil Company, headquartered in Houston, Texas. Without some experience in espionage, though, Bush's selection as CIA director in 1974 seems definitely odd, to say the least. And more than one reliable source claims Zapata was a cover for CIA operations from its inception. In any case, Zapata happens to be the CIA's code name for the Bay of Pigs invasion. And for an extra measure of conspiracy spice, two of the support vehicle vessels for the operation were identified as the Houston and the Barbara. Houston was George Bush's hometown, and Barbara was his wife's first name. Now, these designations are intriguing because during his World War II escapades as a pilot, Bush named every aircraft after his wife, the indomitable Barbara Bush. Now, another coincidence involves the same former president, George H.W. Bush, and the assassination of President Kennedy on November 22, 1963. 1 week after that event, an official FBI document noted the information on possible Cuban exile involvement in the president's death had been received, orally furnished, to Mr. George Bush at the Central Intelligence Agency and Captain William Edwards of the Defense Intelligence Agency on November 23, 1963, by Mr. W.T. Forsyth of this bureau. Well, when a reprint of this document appeared in a July 1988 issue of The Nation on the cusp of Bush's run for the presidency, the CIA quickly issued a statement claiming Mr. George Bush was not really the current candidate for the highest office in the land, but a different man with a similar name. George William Bush. Now, this appeared to deflect suspicion about the presidential candidate's hidden career as a spook, but only until George William Bush emerged from obscurity to admit that, yes, he'd once been employed by the CIA, among other government offices, but only as a low-level research and analyst clerk. He blew the CIA's claim out of the water with an affidavit swearing, "I have carefully reviewed the FBI memorandum to the director, Bureau of Intelligence and Research, Department of State, dated November 29, 1963, that mentions a Mr. George Bush of the Central Intelligence Agency." He went on to say, "I don't recognize the contents of the memorandum as information furnished to me orally or otherwise during the time I was with the CIA. In fact, during my time at the CIA, I didn't receive any oral communications from any government agency of any nature whatsoever. I did not receive any information relating to the Kennedy assassination during my time at the CIA from the FBI. Based on the above, it's my conclusion I'm not the George Bush of the Central Intelligence Agency referred to in that memorandum." Well, that leaves the logical conclusion that it was George H.W. Bush who was a CIA operative at a time when he claimed he wasn't. And not surprising, given the CIA's understandable reluctance to admit anything it doesn't have to. But Bush also had, at the same time, an alliance with Cuban exiles who were furious with Kennedy's disassociation with the Bay of Pigs failure, encouraging some observers to make a linkage between Bush and two catastrophic events in U.S. history: the 1961 Bay of Pigs invasion and the 1963 assassination of John Kennedy. The media, of course, rushed to protect George H.W. Bush, so they chose to discount both connections, leading conspiracy buffs into a round of speculation that's endured for decades. From time to time, Skull and Bones lashes out at those who dare probe too deeply into its operations, as it apparently did when Netherlands TV producer David DeWitt completed a documentary on the group. His premise connected Skull and Bones with the CIA and drug smuggling activities as a means of financing unapproved covert operations. Now, this was a tactic actually confirmed during the Iran-Contra hearings in 1988. Before his production could air, he was ordered by the Netherlands government to remove all reference to the CIA and drugs and soften its criticism of Skull and Bones. The deletions reduced the program's running time from its 80 minutes to barely 30. Completed in 1998, the show was aired once in the U.S. on a Friday at 5 p.m. when, as DeWitt notes, every possible viewer is in traffic going home. It was never repeated. In August of 2003, DeWitt recalled his experience with the CIA and Skull and Bones and noted these institutions and their members show a brute force and an enormous concentrated power that's overwhelming and can make everybody very cynical, very easily. There also has to be a reason people like to stay away from these realities. We don't want to admit we're being manipulated by faceless people in the shadows. Now, Skull and Bones is no more immune to the passage of time and its changes than anybody else. Whatever influence and impact it had beyond the Yale campus may actually be lessening. The 2004 presidential election, after all, featured Bonesman George W. Bush, class of 68, against John Kerry, who was also a member of Skull and Bones. Now, depending on your point of view, this proves either that Skull and Bones members dominate the U.S. political arena to an extent nobody imagined, or that the vaunted conspiracy didn't exist, because why would two conspirators face each other across an ideological divide? Well, whatever may be the answer to that question, innermost secrets of Skull and Bones have been leaking through the stone walls of the tomb for years now, even as the reality of the outside world has been seeping into it. Surely the most important change occurred in 1992 when, after a bitter rearguard battle by old Bonesman, one, a prestige Washington area lawyer, suggested a co-ed membership would lead to date rape. The organization actually agreed to admit women. By 2006, of the 15 Skull and Bones members that year were female. The changes wrought by the last 40 years of social upheaval have had an impact. Skull and Bones now admits Jews and blacks as potential members, something it avoided during the first 150 years of its existence. And it make it doubtful many of the old initiation rites, such as relating one's sexual history while stretched out naked in the coffin, are still practiced. With an estimated $4 million in assets by the year 2000, it can still afford to pay the $15,000 stipend and award a grandfather clock at marriage to each member. The spectacle of both U.S. presidential candidates being Skull and Bone members may represent the dying echo of the society's excessive influence on the country's political and judicial systems. In a day of handheld instant messaging, global economics, and tech-based fortunes, the networking arrangements that boosted the U.S. privileged class even higher in the pecking order isn't nearly as influential or even necessary any longer. The male WASP contingent of American society is no longer as exclusive as it was a generation ago. And secret societies on campus are considered at best anachronisms, a throwback to days of panty raids and silly rich boys in raccoon coats. Skull and Bones, to many, appear to be stumbling toward extinction. In recent years, more Yale juniors have declined an invitation to become a member than have accepted it. But its influence during the past century deserves a great deal of consideration. To many of its best and brightest were involved in too many economic and foreign policy disasters, from the Bay of Pigs through the Kennedy assassination of Vietnam and Iraq, to assess it as an exclusively campus crowd, a bunch of advantaged young men playing silly games in a dark tomb-like room. There's a whole lot more to the story. But the question is, who is going to be able to tell it? You know, secret societies have long fascinated people. And the more certainty we have in our own lives, the more we're intrigued by mysteries. The entertainment value is obvious, but we also need threats to our security in order to fully appreciate the existence of that security. In the process, we speculate about things we can't explain and often become fixed on threats and events well removed from our present-day lives. It's more comforting that way, which perhaps explains why the greatest concentration of secret society concerns rests in urban Europe and affluent North America. whose residents have the most to lose materially and spiritually, as we are seeing right now with all the riots and upheaval that have gone on over the Black Lives Matter. For those of us detached from direct association with shadow people, it's the secrecy that's the most worrisome, and the potential impact on our lives that's the most threatening. An attitude that, of course, varies according to proximity. To citizens of Calabria and Sicily, the Mafia is a reality that need not be speculated about because its presence and influence are evident. Similar attitudes may be found among residents of Hong Kong and Macau, who experience triad activities firsthand, and Japanese businessmen encountering crimes committed by Yakuza. To both groups, the secret in secret societies is something of a contradiction when their direct impact is confronted daily. At the other end of the spectrum, yak farmers in Mongolia, refugees in Somalia, and Inuit in Baffin Island grapple daily with a range of challenges to their survival that middle-class Americans and Europeans just simply can't grasp. Plotting their very existence occupies too much of their consciousness to speculate about the impact of millennia-old foreign-based conspiracies, even as entertainment. To the rest of us, though, secret denotes mystery, and mysteries demand solutions. And when solutions are unavailable, speculation runs rampant. And when speculation is unleashed from reason and motivated by innuendo, we begin to sense that we're surrounded by conspiracies, believing in their existence even when faced with evidence that it's all smoke and mirrors. The more comfortable and predictable our lives become, the more positively we react to the notion of widespread conspiracies because their existence provides a resolution to various unsolved mysteries. Conspiracies supply blame for terrible events that remain beyond our ability to fathom. No better example exists than the assassination of John Kennedy. Those who can't accept Lee Harvey Oswald acting alone could gun down one of the most admired men of his time, look for evidence to support their disbelief. And the mere fact that Oswald was never indicted, denied he did it, never convicted, but has been called in every single thing I've read the assassin, in this incidents, there may be much yet to be found, as we saw with when we talked about Skull and Bones, but on a grander scale, we may ascribe the failure of our economic dreams to an unfathomable and shadowy cartel, the defeat of a favored politician or an international cabal, unexplained climactic events to supernatural forces controlled by covens. We never want to admit we may personally have a failing. The growing appeal of secret explanations for catastrophic events has paralleled the impact of contemporary popular culture, with each element feeding the other. Popular novels and movies once dealt with people engaged in direct association with each other. Their motivations varied between love and war, and often involving both, but they were for the most part open, not shadowy occurrences. Today's popular culture vehicles find more inspiration not in events we can fathom, but in secrets that defy our explanation, held by organizations operating within shadows. Consider, if you will, the mystery novel. Most observers trace its origins back to Edgar Allan Poe's 1843 tale, The Gold Bug. His literary descendant, Dashiell Hammett, created the prototypical private eye to solve crimes committed by individuals whose closest association with international conspiracy was usually the syndicate, which was a code word for the mafia. Others, such as Arthur Conan Doyle, John Buchanan, Sax Rohmer, who created Fu Manchu, and Sapper, a pen name for Herman Cyril McNeil, author of the Bulldog Drummond series, pursued criminals who functioned on a one-to-one scale with their victims, all the while committing robbery, murder, and similar unsavory and intriguing activities. Secret societies rarely appeared in popular literature until relatively recently. Readers of Ayn Rand suggested her novel Atlas Shrugged deals with values associated with the Illuminati, which may explain the basis for the book's popularity. Communists were a familiar target in American novels of the 1950s, but in this case, familiarity appears to have bred boredom. Communists were an everyday element in news broadcasts, which made them feckless villains in fiction for the most part. Then came Ian Fleming and progeny such as William Ludland and John Grisham to address readers' fears of shadowy conspirators exerting widespread power over the lives of ordinary people. Variation on this plot device blasted the Harry Potter series into the records as history's most successful publishing phenomenon in children's books and literature generally. At least three secret societies, such as the Order of the Phoenix, are involved in the Potter plots, each threatening not only the hero and his cohorts, but the security of the world itself. Now, Harry Potter and his cohorts are fun to read about, of course, even when he's scooting over the moors pursued by shadowy villains. And this is unusual in spite of near farcical aspects of organizations such as the Rosicrucians, likely born of a college student prank and the unfortunate death of a Freemason initiate. Secret societies are rarely subject to parody in popular culture. On television, Jackie Gleason's early 1950s comedy, The Honeymooners, frequently included the International Order of Friendly Sons of the Raccoons, whose lodge members acted suspiciously like Masons and Shriners. They had code words and flapping the tails and raccoon skin caps at each other.
Detected at the front door.
More recently and more acerbically, television series The Simpsons has included the Stonecutters in several of its plots. Clearly, these are based on Freemasons. The Stonecutters meet weekly in a pyramid-shaped building where they honor their sacred parchment before drinking heavily and playing ping-pong. And for proof of their power, the Stonecutters claim to control the British monarchy and prevent the metric system from being used in the U.S. You have to admit, it is an accurate, devastating, and hilarious parody of the lighter side of secret societies. In a more serious vein, film adaptations of Ian Fleming's James Bond series were among the first to spark Hollywood's interest in international conspiracies. Partially because Fleming managed to tap the public's fascination with evil secret societies. Bond's nemesis, Spectre, the special executive for counterintelligence, terrorism, revenge, and extortion, elevated the idea of foreign exiled men with sociopathic qualities and unlimited sources of wealth to an over-the-top level that was consistently entertaining, but never within the realm of possibility or reality. Similarly, later films based on books by Robert Ludlum, Lynn Denton, and others usually based their conspiracies and conflicts on clashes between the American CIA, British MI6, and the Russian KGB. With periodic excursions, I might add, into the realms of Nazi revivals and the Israeli Mossad. It took Francis Ford Coppola's Godfather trilogy to depict Cosa Nostra with shocking realism. And Raiders of the Lost Ark, the first of Steven Spielberg's Indiana Jones series, explored contemporary antics of ancient secret societies with a healthy injection of Nazi villains. And going even further, maybe because its existence is for the most part unconfirmable, the Bavarian Illuminati often gets involved as murky villains in movies and video games. I point you at the 2001 film Lara Croft Tomb Raider, which reversed the traditional order of game spinning off movies when it adapted a best-selling video game into a major film production, which starred Angelina Jolie and John Voight. And the plot, not surprisingly, considering its source, suggests a new definition for silliness. It pits Ms. Jolie's character against the Illuminati's ability to control time. Then there's another popular computer game, Deus Ex. It features the Illuminati as a secret society controlling the world in company with the Knights Templar. In addition to its political and economic powers exerted via the World Trade Organization and Deus Ex, the Illuminati maintains a hidden store of viruses to be unleashed on groups or entire countries that fail to meet its demands. Now, the Templars are less clearly drawn, representing one of four forces the player may join to achieve the game's objectives. Neither group bears much similarity to the actual namesake organizations. I played that game. It's fascinating. Through all its literary, cinematic, and computer game productions, readers and viewers found it easy to draw a distinct line between fantasy and reality. Viewers of The Godfather left the movie theater feeling they'd acquired an insight into the operations of Cosa Nostra, but few felt any new threat to their lives. And both the film and the book it was based on ignored the historic heritage behind the organizations, choosing to focus on actions of ruthless criminals united by blood and marriage who saw their work as simply a means of doing business. These groups were real, no question about it. But the threat, while also real, is distant. And the Mafia's historical roots were never addressed, which frankly would have made for a much more interesting story. Not until Umberto Eco's philosophical satire, Foucault's Pendulum, in which three Italian editors become caught up in an apparent linkage between historical secret societies extending back to the crucifixion, did a major movie deal with historical facts. In Eco's rampant and often hilarious tale, organizations such as the Templars, Freemasons, Priory de Sion, Assassins, Rosicrucians, Kabbalah, Druids, and Gnostics pop up both as historical relics and contemporary participants. Part Marx Brothers movie script and part Robert Ludlum thriller and part philosophical treatise, this 1988 narrative satisfied two wildly disparate groups. Conspiracy buffs who suspected 8 billion lives on the planet are controlled by a handful of shadowy plotters, and skeptics who revel in the delight of seeing the Emperor's new wardrobe finally being revealed. Well, Foucault's Pendulum was clearly inspired by a 1982 book published as nonfiction, but a lot of folks believe was a work of fantasy loosely based on facts, and that's the Holy Blood and Holy Grail. And that appeared 6 years before Eco's opus came out, but while the latter was amusing and enlightening to readers who follow its meandering plot and respond to its cynical humor, the Holy Blood, Holy Grail ignited something else among a more gullible public. It was inspired by the experiences of a British film producer and former actor named Henry Soskin, whose previous claim to fame had been performing bit parts in the 1960s TV event series The Avengers. Changing his name to Henry Lincoln and changing his position from in front of the camera to behind it, he detected a missing translation of an encrypted message in an obscure book on René Lachateau. Excuse me. After researching the tale of Father Saunier and his mysterious wealth, Lincoln produced a documentary film about the supposed treasure, milking the story for every nuance to heighten the drama. And sometime later, Lincoln encountered a university lecturer and budding novelist named Richard Leigh, who harbored a fascination with the Knights Templar. Now, maybe the Templars and the Saunier mystery could be linked together somehow, tracking a tale extending from Christ's crucifixion down to contemporary times. And Leigh recruited a former photojournalist named Michael Bagent, and together this threesome invested 4 years researching, speculating, postulating, and finally writing a book that spun 100,000 words of conjecture into a theory connecting virtually every secret society in the world, in reality or fantasy, over 2,000 years. At the core of this story were three unconfirmed and unconfirmable assertions. One, Christ didn't die on the cross, an imposter took his place, permitting Christ to escape across the Mediterranean to the south of France, where he created a dynasty. They also allege Christ wasn't single and celibate. He was a rabbi. Rabbis are, by tradition, married. And in this story, he married Mary Magdalene and fathered at least one child, who accompanied the parents on that journey. And the descendants of Christ's children have been active in determining the fate of the world for over 2,000 years. Now, interestingly enough, when I did my family history, I am descended from the Merovingians, which is the line that Christ supposedly gave birth to. Now, as a premise for a historical novel, this is outstanding material. In the hands of authors as divergent in their periods and styles as Thomas Costain and Don DeLillo, It could have been a respectable flight of fancy and an entertaining, even informative, peek at some of history's most interesting events. Well, the authors and their publisher didn't see it this way. They believed that the impact of a nonfiction hypothesis had a better opportunity of generating interest and sales than a historical novel, and they were actually correct. When Holy Blood, Holy Grail appeared on the bestseller list almost on the day of its publication in 1982. It also managed to inspire the only book that seriously challenged the Harry Potter series for sales in recent years, and that's Dan Brown's The Da Vinci Code. And up until that point, Brown had hardly distinguished himself as a writer destined for greatness. His previous work, Angels and Demons, blended the Illuminati and the Syrian Ismailis into a laughingly awkward manner, and included the author's erroneous assumptions that Muslims in Syria, Iraq, Iran, and India all speak and write the same language. Well, Holy Blood and Da Vinci Code are as closely linked as any literary parent and progeny can be, even to the extent of each mirroring the other. Holy Blood's imaginative fiction posing as reality, and Da Vinci's pseudo-reality posing as fiction. And despite his assertions that many of the organization's characters and events in his book are real, Brown can neatly sidestep criticism about his novel by pointing at the fiction designation. The authors who concocted Holy Blood have no such defense except their protest of unfair attacks by skeptical critics delivered with great passion and conviction in the later editions of their book. But complaints of unfair criticism can't overcome weaknesses that fail to suspend disbelief among readers who actually know their history. Throughout their story, the authors frequently pose the query, what if? What if the power of the Templars rose to the same extent as a prominent individual happened to be their contemporary? Does that prove a relationship? Well, it suggests one, but it hardly proves it. Once their what-if premise is established, it's treated from that point forward like a proven assertion on which the entire network of suppositions is based. The result is a spider web that supports its builder, but could easily be swept away. Most serious works of nonfiction base their premise on accessible facts established by a credible source identified to the reader. Holy Blood authors take a new approach. History can only be seriously interpreted, they claim, when the researcher seeks conclusions from among apparently unrelated events, even when the events are at best apocryphal. In effect, they suggest that documented facts are no more important, and maybe less so, than myths. If this is the case, an enormous volume of new information awaits discovery by imaginative historians who link, for example, the 1944 consolidation of Nazi power in Europe with the winter's unprecedented level of snowfall in North America. And certainly there could be a connection. The analogy of a spider's web may favor the strength of the web over the ability of Holy Blood to sustain close examination. Well, we've come to the end of this show. We'll be back tomorrow, and we're going to talk about some, and this being the Halloween season, it's probably appropriate, some unexplained and unsolved murders. Till then, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great evening.